Good day, my friends, and welcome to the Craig Shapiro Tennis Podcast. Today's show is brought to you by Diadora, the brand made legendary by Bjorn Borg and currently worn by world number 25 Jan-Lennard Struff, world number 60 Martina Trevisan. See them at Diadora.com. Use my code APPROVED in all caps at HollibergSports.com for 15% off of all Diadora performance tennis shoes. Grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, reached the finals of the Kalamazoo 18s, and was an All-American for the Texas Longhorns in the early 80s. He got to 120 in the world in singles and has a win over one of our sport's special athletes. He reached the quarters of the French and U.S. Open doubles, and we talked about it all. He is the founder and owner of the Arizona Tennis Classic, which is a challenger that begins next week, and because of its date, boasts a ridiculous lineup. Johnny Levine is today's guest. Are you in Phoenix?
I am in Phoenix, Craig, yes.
And you're born and raised Phoenix?
Born and raised in Phoenix, correct.
And did you ever live anywhere else? Like I say, did you live somewhere? You have to have the mailing address. Did your mail ever go to a different place other than Phoenix?
Always Phoenix.
Always Phoenix?
Yeah. Except for college.
Prodigal yeah. Son. For our listeners, gentlemen, you hear, you know, our show, we always have the most interesting people in the sport on. This gentleman is certainly one of them. He floats way under the radar in a lot of circles, but the people that really know, they know who he is. Distinguished himself at the University of Texas in the early 80s, the Longhorn, twice All-American, and has the distinction of playing doubles with a guy that they say was one of the greatest servers there ever was. We're going to talk about it all. He's the tournament director of one of the most interesting events in the country. We're going to talk about it. Johnny Levine. Now, Johnny, do I have all that right?
You're spot on, Craig. You nailed it.
Spot on. Spot on.
Yep.
And were we born in Phoenix?
You know what? My folks both were from Brooklyn, New York. They came to Phoenix in 1960.
Okay.
And I was born in 1963. So I do have some roots in New York, but I am a true Phoenician and a true native.
Wow. Phoenician. Now, listen, as you know, we do the five-set format. The first set's the off-the-court report. You've got an event coming up in Phoenix at the Phoenix Country Club. What's your weather there now? Are you guys under control or is it terrible weather?
No, we are in great shape right now,
okay.
Craig. The weather typically is very, very great in March, and we always pray for good weather. And right now it's 70 degrees, and we're keeping our fingers crossed that we don't have any rain during the tournament.
Now, Scottsdale had a tournament that Agassi owned. A lot of people probably don't know that. Scottsdale is a golf and tennis hotbed. It's one of the top places. Nobody talks about Phoenix. Now, is Phoenix an under-the-radar spot?
I don't think it is. I think the popularity with tennis in this state and in this town is very high. It's unfortunate that the Scottsdale Open, you know, left in the early 2000s, actually played in the event in the 80s, and it was a fun tournament. It was a great tournament, but it couldn't sustain itself. And then it ended up moving to Las Vegas, like you said.
And Scottsdale, it's about 45 minutes an hour.
No, less. It's basically 10, 15 minutes. It just borders Phoenix.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it borders Phoenix. Yeah. I mean, we were just, you know, raring to get pro tennis back here. And, you know, that was the impetus of my, you know, efforts to try to get it back.
And the tennis, I mean, that Scottsdale and Phoenix, that's a hot action town, man. I've been down there. That's a hot action town.
Well, and especially in the spring when there's so many different events, you've got the Waste Management Open, the golf tournament, you've got the Barrett-Jackson car show, you've got spring training, you've got Suns games, Coyotes games.
Awesome.
There's so much going on. The weather's great. We get a lot of winter visitors, and it's a lot of fun.
Let's move into the second set. This is the On the Court Report. You are the tournament director of the Arizona Tennis Classic. The reason we're going to even talk about this is because you fill an interesting spot. Your spot is essentially the second week of Indian Wells in between Miami.
Correct.
And because of that, you get one of the most ilmatic draws in the history of a challenger event.
Exactly. I mean, our cutoff this year, Craig, the initial cutoff, and it will change because people that end up getting past the third round of past the second round of Indian Wells and are entered in our tournament will fall out, and then the cutoff will go down a little bit.
Of course.
But we're 69 initial cutoff.
So every player in the draw is top 70 in the world. That's incredible. Wow.
Exactly. And I do want to clarify, I do have a tournament director. I'm the founder of the event. The tournament director is actually Weller Evans.
Oh, Weller. Okay. So this is incredible. How much is a ticket?
Well, the tickets range from about $20 starting on the Monday, and they go up to $45 to $55 on the weekend for the semis and finals. And we've probably got over 30 sponsors. We have three main sponsors.
That's sick. Berrettini won this.
In 2019, the inaugural champion.
And what about Struff?
Struff last year got to the semifinals.
Oh, Struff semi, but this was like a bounce off for him.
Yes, it was.
And this is incredible because it's like you go for less than $100. You can't even go have lunch for less than $100 in Scottsdale.
Exactly. It's a great value, Craig. And best part about it for the fans, it's a very intimate setting.
Yeah.
So you're right up on the court. I mean, literally.
And what about the food?
The food is fantastic. The Phoenix Country Club serves it. There's a grill out there. There's a tent for the public area. And then there's a VIP area for the sponsors that is food and beverages included in the sponsorships.
Yeah.
And, we tent it and the weather's, when the weather's good, it's just looking out at the golf course. The setting is fantastic.
We might have to do an academy there next year, and just because we just get out. You know what we do is we'll come out of the Indian Wells, and we'll run an academy at the Arizona Tennis Classic. Get right down in it. We might have to do that. What about the crowd? Are there is it like people single and ready to mingle?
It's a great environment. Tuesday through Friday, there are day sessions starting at 10. On Friday, it starts at 12, and then the night session Tuesday through Friday is at 7 p.m., two featured matches.
Oh, you have a night session?
Yes, we do.
That's terrific. And the courts are the same quality as the Miami and Indian Wells, high quality?
Fantastic quality. We have resurfaced courts every year right before the event, so they're all the same surface.
And really?
We try to make it a great environment, a great facility for the players. And
who pays for that? Who pays for the resurfacing?
We have to do everything, Craig. I mean, we're basically a tenant during the week of the tournament, of the country club, and we put a lot of funds and financial investment into the tournament to make it the best it can be for the players.
Fantastic. Listen, you know how I feel about pro tennis. You know how I feel about tournaments going away. So I am a big supporter of this. I've heard nothing but great things about your event. But you're on the show because you've had a special life in tennis. Let's move into the third set. This is the portion of our show where we talk about your career. Now, Johnny, where does your tennis begin?
My tennis began in Phoenix at a small tennis club called the Westside Tennis Club, where Mort Stone was the pro. He was an older gentleman from New York. He had a lot of national champions. He had NCAA champions. He had Stephanie Tollison, who won the NCAAs. He had Bruce Nichols, who went on to UCLA, won the NCAAs in doubles and had a pro career. Stuart Keller, who went to the University of Texas and played with Kern and Denton and Plock. Who came, I came after him, and that's how I ended up going to UT. But basically, this Westside Tennis Club was the place to be, had all the great juniors in the Southwest section.
Hard courts.
All hard courts. We didn't have, the weather here, you can't do clay or anything. There was one small indoor club, but basically all the best players in town played at Westside and played against each other, and Mort ran that program.
And that's how you got good, just battling there. When were you identified as a good player?
Well, I mean, I won the Southwest section in every age group and started to play national juniors in the 12s and was top 10 in the country, you know, in the 14s and ended up getting to the finals of Kalamazoo in the 18s. And then,
hold on a second. You finaled Kalamazoo.
Correct.
Who'd you play in the final?
Jimmy Brown.
Who'd you beat in the semi?
Jonathan Cantor or, Cantor in the semis. Yeah. Michael Cures in the
Jonathan
course.
Cantor. Yep. Jonathan Cantor. Should get him to sponsor your event. Now, that's no joke. When you final Kalamazoo, that essentially means you're one of the best players in the whole country.
Well, yeah, that year I ended up, I had a great Kalamazoo, and then I finaled the grass courts. I had a great year, you know, was on the Junior Davis Cup. Matt Anger was number one in the country, won Junior Wimbledon, I believe, that summer. And Jimmy Brown, you know, was playing up, actually. He had won the 16s and he won the 18s. He turned pro. And then I went to the University of Texas, landed there the next semester, and that's where I played my college tennis. I was basically looking at going to either UCLA, where Bruce Nichols went, who played at the same club as me, or University of Texas, where Stuart Keller went. And I chose University of Texas to play under Dave Snyder. That's where Kevin Curran went, Steve Denton went. And that's where I played my college tennis.
This is like a who's who of American collegiate tennis. Where was McEnroe was right in there, huh? He was there at Stanford right then?
McEnroe was a little older than me. And
So he was already playing pro tennis. He was already winning Wimbledon.
Exactly. Yeah.
You came right after him.
Yeah, I came right after him. And so I was playing against actually my junior year. Paul Anacone was number one in the country, and I was number two in the country that year.
And did you play Paul?
You know, I played Paul not in actually college. We first time we ever played was 14 Orange Bowl, and then we played on the pro tour in Boston, and I got him on clay. But Paul really had my number most of the time we played.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, people, they see him on Tennis Channel and he's, you know, they forget this guy was a bad dude.
Tremendous.
He didn't lose a lot of matches. Yeah.
Quarters of Wimbledon.
Former world number eight.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And Brad Gilbert and you guys are the same age.
Me and Brad, Brad might be a couple years older. The way I really got to know Brad was when I was playing as a junior here, 17 years old, 16, 17, I practiced a lot out at ASU. And there was a coach there that I was pretty close to, Marty Pincus, that had recruited Brad. And so Brad went there actually just for, I believe, maybe just a semester. But I would go out, hit with Brad all the time. His first semester, we had played in the Maccabiah games together prior to that and won a gold medal in doubles. So
for our listeners, if you don't know what that is, the Maccabiah games is like an Olympics for Jewish players. And you play with Brad in the Maccabiah games. I mean, that actually goes to show you how prestigious it is. I mean, people take that very serious.
Yeah, we had a pretty good tournament. We actually had a semifinal match that was crazy against David Egdes, who actually is the vice president of Tennis Channel.
Yep.
Was a really good player at Trinity. And Brian Levine, who played at University of Miami, who was a great player. We beat those guys 12-10 in the third and the finals. I believe we upset Paul Bernstein, who played at ASU, and Ricky Meyer. So we really, you know, were fortunate to win that. It was a great win for us.
What was it like being a good player back in the 80s like that? That had to have been a lot of fun.
Oh, I mean, it was great. Yeah. I mean, it was a different game.
Yeah.
I mean, ooh, totally, you know, a lot of serve and volley, and it was just, guys were, there were a lot of, you know, the Americans really dominated the tour in that era.
Is that right? Is that how you felt?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. There were 20, 25 guys in the top 100 back then.
And you got to 120 in the world in singles and you got to 40 in doubles.
Yes.
So how did you decide to turn pro? What was that like?
Okay. So when I went to college, I had a great run my freshman year, beating Rodney Harmon, who was one in the country, was picked for the College Davis Cup team. So I got some great experience playing pro events that summer. My sophomore year, lost in the quarters of the NCAAs, had a good run, lost to David Pate. And then my junior year, right before it, I played that summer on the Davis Cup team and got to the third round of the U.S. Open and lost to Lendl. I had some great results. Played that fall as a pro and was really thinking of maybe turning pro even in the fall. Didn't do that great. Went back for my last semester, for my junior spring semester, where I had a great run and got, you know, to the semis, the NCAAs. I was favored to win. I lost to Pern Forz in a real tight three-setter. And decided, you know, at that point I was 2 in the country and I was ready to turn pro, and that's what I did.
Damn. And what was it like to, you know, turn pro?
You know, it was a slow start for me. I had a great, great run in the satellite circuits where I won a bunch of satellites, a bunch of tournaments in a row.
Yeah, you can see your results, and it looked like you played well at that level, and the results weren't there when you turned pro. You didn't crack the top 100 in singles. Was that very difficult?
Yeah, no, it was a tough run. I think I put a lot of pressure on myself, a lot of expectations. You know, I think, you know, I had some good results in singles. You know, I played some really great players, and I think I needed better kind of mental preparation. And when I was able to take that pressure off, I seem to have much better results, especially in the doubles. But I expected to be in the top 50 and I didn't get there. But, you know, looking back, there's no regrets. And I did the best I could with what I had.
You did the best you could.
I think I did.
Listen, by the way, you're in the last 8 club in Paris and at the US Open. Yeah, you did that with a guy that, as I said, when I teed you up, that this guy is supposed to have one of the greatest serves in the history of tennis, Eric Kurita. You got to tell us about Eric Kurita.
Well, Eric and I go way back from the 12 and unders. We met. There was a bunch of us that became very friendly, and we did. And
by the way, that's Kurita, Eric Kurita.
Correct. And Eric got up to top 40 in singles and top 30 in doubles. And the first time we played together was on that junior Davis Cup college team. And we were able to win the Pan American Games in a wild three-setter in 1983. And Eric went on, he played 2 years. He had gotten to the third round of the Open twice as an amateur and then turned pro. But Eric's serve was considered by everyone in the 80s to be the fastest serve in the world. And everyone knew it, and it was just a known fact, and I was fortunate to have some great results with him in doubles.
And he was bad to the bone, and didn't he have, like, a monster kicker?
Oh, do you know that we played, I believe it was in the third round of 88, we played Mike DePalmer and Gary Donnelly, and he literally, on a second serve, hit a kick serve that bounced over the fence behind those guys on one bounce.
The guy had a crazy, crazy serve. And it wasn't even, didn't he play with a Prince racket?
He did.
Play with a Prince Pro, maybe?
I forget, you know, the big one, the original one. He did a lot of commercials for them. Do you remember?
Yeah.
You remember him?
Guys are older than me, but I, you know, his name, and I knew that he was famous for this serve, Eric Kurita. So you were just picking off, if these guys were turning the ball, he made it easy for you, it sounds like.
Oh, my God. It was crazy. The thing about playing with Eric was, you know, what I was always nervous about was getting hit in the back with that serve, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Thank God that didn't happen. But, no, his serve was monstrous.
Monstrous.
It was crazy. He had great groundies, too.
Did he?
I mean, the guy, he just didn't move that great. But, I mean, he was a tremendous player. And, you know, we thought maybe he'd do a little better, but, you know, he had some injuries. And again, he was happy with his career, I think, and did pretty darn good.
Man, you guys are the final last eight club, man. It's like incredible. Your best win?
Agassi.
Oh, really? Where'd you beat Andre?
That was in 1986, his first pro event in a tournament in Florida. A satellite event, and I beat him in the finals, 6-0, 6-1.
Where?
Tournament, and I believe it was in Tampa. I'm not sure which city in Florida, but it was a satellite in Florida, and there were 5 events. It was the first event of the satellite.
Come on.
Yeah.
Wait, does that mean you registered his first loss as a pro player? Could that be?
Well, he did get to the finals of his first pro event. You could look at it that way too.
No. But are you the, do you have the distinction of beating, you're the first loss he ever took in pro tennis?
I think so. I never looked at it that way, but yeah, I think so.
Wow, Johnny, you've been underselling yourself. We got to check that. We're going to check that. That's not official.
Okay.
Your worst loss, like the most vicious loss there ever was.
Oh, well, that's pretty easy. I hate to bring it back, but that was when I was up 6-1, 5-4, serving 2-1 in the game in the semis of the NCAAs to Michael Pernfors. And things shifted not in my favor right after that. He was able to break me, and we got into a tiebreaker, and I ended up losing, I think, one or two in the third. He played Lawson Duncan in the finals, who I had beaten earlier in the year. And, you know, that was a tough one for me, for sure.
I mean, Michael McCombie, you're playing some of the greatest, you mentioned some of the greatest names in the history of tennis. Mikhail Pernfors, French Open finalist, top 30 guy for a lot of years, had an incredible career. What prompted retirement? What happened to you after retirement?
Well, you know, I had been out there about 5 years,
yeah,
and I kind of got a little burned out, and I just felt like I had maxed out mentally. Doubles, I was still 40 in the world, but I chose to make the transition. I felt like, you know, if I hang on there in the doubles for a few more years, it's just going to be tougher and tougher to make that transition into the business world, is what, which I did. And I met my future wife, which Polly Levine, and we traveled the last year together, went to all the slams, and that was great that she could experience that with me. And then I was ready to you know, go on to the next chapter of my life, and which was 1988.
And what was that?
89.
Were you a Wall Street? What is that, Wall Street stuff?
No, I went into the outdoor advertising business here in Phoenix, the billboard business.
Billboards.
Yes, billboards.
Yo, that's the name of my game. I got the number one billboard in Indian Wells. You know that?
No, I did not.
See my I'm the number one billboard. But maybe next year I'll get a billboard for your tournament.
100%.
All right, let's move into the fourth set. This is the 10-ball scramble. I say it, and you say what comes in your mind, okay?
Yep.
We go fast. Your favorite tournament?
U.S. Open.
Your favorite city?
London.
Big entourage or lean and mean?
For sure, lean and mean.
What do you do with your credentials? Did you save your credentials all the years, or did you throw them away?
I've got a few. I wished I had saved them, but all the events that I've gone to after my career, for some reason, I've saved them. But I've got a few, but not many.
The ones you have now, where do you keep them?
Oh, they're in a drawer in my house, in my little office that I have. They're there.
You got them in a drawer. You got to show them to people. Now, what racket did you play with?
Well, I started out with the Jack Kramer Pro Staff.
Of course.
Wood racket.
Yeah.
Then I went to the Wilson Ultra, and then they eventually made an Ultra that had like a mid-size to it, not an oversize. And so that was the racket that I ended up playing with.
And how'd you string that racket?
I think I generally was with gut, and it was at 62.
Wow, 62. You guys strung tight.
Tight.
No one even talks about 62 anymore. Is that wild?
Yeah.
Size of your grip?
4.5.
Leather grip?
Fairway. Always had a fairway grip on it.
Leather fairway grip.
Yep.
Your favorite player growing up?
Bjorn Borg.
Favorite player now? Someone you love to watch?
Novak Djokovic.
Your favorite forehand? He's thinking, everybody. Come on, man. It's quick.
You mean of all time?
It's a 10-ball scramble. You say it. You say it.
Del Potro.
Favorite backhand?
Stan Wawrinka.
Volleys?
Stefan Edberg.
And serve?
Pete Sampras.
And what about on the women's side? Who do you like? Whose strokes do you like?
Steffi's forehand. I love seeing her win all those slams and gold medal at the Olympics, and just loved her low keyness. I just thought she was so classy.
Let's move into the fifth and final set. This is the king of the court. If you could be the king of tennis and make a change of the sport with just a swing of the racket, what would it be?
I have two things. Can I share two?
Come on, baby. Let's go.
Mandatory electronic line calling. for all tournaments. Number one.
Yeah, that seems like a no-brainer.
No-brainer. And then I think that, you know, appearance fees should go away and be added to the prize money of the tournament, because I think it should be shared amongst all the players.
Now, do you ever have to talk to these agents and they ask for an appearance fee from you? Has that happened?
No, they don't even. I mean, even though we're a Challenger 175, we're not in that realm.
Now, is there any chance you're going to bump up to a bigger tournament? Is that something that could happen or no?
You know, I don't know how that calendar works. That's a difficult,
you have what you have and you do what you do.
And we're really happy with the week we have. And everyone is, you know, we've done it since 19. It's got a lot of momentum, but we're always looking to improve the event. That's for sure.
Hey, man, listen, as you know, I appreciate you coming on the show. You had an incredible career in pro tennis. You know, I saw you in Paris. I've seen you at the US Open. I've seen you at Indian Wells. You're a man around this sport. Everyone says that this Arizona Challenger is fantastic. I do have to come see it. What's the website?
ArizonaTennisClassic.com. And there's a link on that site that will direct you right where you can go to get your tickets.
ArizonaTennisClassic.com starts on the 11th and ends on the 17th, correct?
That's correct.
All right, baby. Listen, thank you. See you in a few days in the desert. Johnny Levine, Phoenix's finest. You are released.
Thank you, Craig.
Huge thank you to Johnny Levine. Thank you to Deodora. Use my code APPROVED in all caps at HollywoodSports.com for 15% off of all Deodora Performance tennis shoes. Megan Fernandez edited the show. Our music is by Brian Senti. We'll be back next time with more of the most interesting voices in the sport. Until then, I'm Craig Shapiro, and you are released.